Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading additional articles published in the Midland Reporter-Telegram Friday, June 24th. From the front page, oil CEOs get olive branch. Sources say Granholm says administration wants to collaborate with industry. By Jennifer A. Drewley and Ari Natter, Bloomberg. The U.S. energy chief struck a conciliatory tone in a high-stakes meeting with top oil executives to discuss soaring gasoline prices on Thursday, though the huddle yielded little progress on a plan to address the supply crunch. For more than an hour, U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm met in Washington with leaders of some of the nation's top oil companies, discussing possible waivers of air pollution limits on fuel and other changes that could help ease pump prices. The meeting was described by multiple people familiar with the discussion who asked for anonymity because it was closed to the public. Granholm stressed that the administration wants to collaborate with the industry to bolster refining capacity and boost gasoline production, the people said. Her opening comments attempted to preempt some oil industry arguments by emphasizing that the administration recognizes refiners need more regulatory certainty and supportive market signals from Washington to drive investment in the sector, according to People. Although Granholm downplayed the possibility of a ban on the export of gasoline and other refined petroleum products, she didn't explicitly rule out trade limits, the people said. Administration officials and executives also extensively discussed the potential for waiving gasoline from anti-smog rules that require low-volatility fuel in the summer, a shift that could reduce costs by allowing fuel blenders to mix in less pricey butane. Such waivers would have to come from the Environmental Protection Agency, which did not have representatives in the meeting, the people said. The group also strategized ways to prepare for possible hurricane disruptions to fuel refining and supply. The secretary set a collaborative tone early on by acknowledging the global nature of oil markets and prices, and that some companies, including Shell, have diminished refining capacity because we're busy converting century-old assets to produce biofuels, Gretchen Watkins, president of Shell USA Incorporated, said in a statement. From the inside pages, oil execs blame Biden for high costs, energy crunch driven by global supply and demand, by James Osborne, staff writer, Washington. After months of jostling with the Biden administration, oil executives are set to sit down with Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm today to try and bring an end to the spike in gasoline prices over the past 6 months. With Americans now paying a record $5 per gallon, the administration is trying any way it can to reduce prices, ordering record releases from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and calling on Congress Wednesday to suspend the federal gasoline tax for 3 months, all with little effect on prices at the pump. At the same time, oil executives are eager to make the case the Biden administration is part of the problem, attempting to move the economy away from oil and other fossil fuels, even though industries and consumers remain very much reliant on them. It's unclear what, if anything, Biden can do to solve an energy crunch driven by oil supply constraints caused by the pandemic and the war in the Ukraine, a decline in U.S. refining capacity, and a surge in consumer demand since lifting the COVID-19 health restrictions. It does feel a little bit of theater on both sides, said Andrew Logan, senior oil and gas director at Ceres, a nonprofit that advises investors on climate. The administration feels like it needs to do something, even though it has very little power to do so, and the industry is trying to not let a crisis go to waste. In his bid to get the United States on the path to net zero emissions by mid-century, Biden has taken aim at the oil and gas industry since taking office last year, holding up lease sales for federal lands and waters and canceling the Keystone XL pipeline project. Some oil executives believe that has contributed to growing skepticism among investors about the future of their industry. In a survey of oil companies conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas in March, close to 60% said investor pressure to control costs and increase profits was keeping them from increasing production. Where shareholders once might have applauded spending billions of dollars to develop new oil and gas fields, now they want to see dividend checks and other moves to increase investor return, energy analysts and executives say. In a letter to Biden Tuesday, Chevron CEO Mike Wirth wrote that oil companies needed cooperation and support from your administration for our country to return to a path toward greater energy security. We need an honest dialogue on how to best balance energy, economic, and environmental objectives, Wirth said. One that recognizes our industry is a vital sector of the U.S. economy and is essential to our national security. Only it's not just Biden that has investors worried. Nations worldwide are shifting from fossil fuels, driven by increasingly dire reports from scientists about the impact of climate change. And the industry struggles to maintain profitability amid regular slumps in crude prices also has turned off many investors, said Ken Medlock, an economist at Rice University. The biggest issue in terms of access to capital, it's a lack of healthy returns over the last decade plus, he said. In terms of the price of oil, the price of gasoline, there is no president that has that much power. But that hasn't stopped Biden from trying. Last week, he sent a letter to oil companies, including ExxonMobil, Chevron, Phillips 66, and Valero, demanding they increase fuel production and pointing out their refining profits have tripled and are currently at their highest levels ever recorded. The crunch that families are facing deserves immediate action, Biden wrote. Your companies need to work with my administration to bring forward concrete near-term solutions that address the crisis. Oil and refining companies maintain there is not much they can do. A decade-long decline in U.S. gasoline demand, driven by more efficient cars, has resulted in domestic refining capacity falling to 18 million barrels a day. Its lowest level in 8 years, according to the research firm S&P Global. Even if companies wanted to increase capacity, building refineries takes years. To say refineries can pop into existence and then going into hiatus is not realistic, said Scott Siegel, an energy attorney in Washington. This meeting is an opportunity for the industry to explain the investment cycle is longer term. Hanging over the meeting today is the reality with which presidents have long struggled to come to grips. Global markets control oil prices, not them. And with global economy coming back to life after 2 years of shutdowns and social restrictions, markets are saying through high prices there is not enough oil to go around. The question Biden faces is whether he should take steps now to prevent a repeat of this year's price spike in the years and decades ahead as the world makes the transition to cleaner forms of energy such as wind turbines, solar panels, and hydrogen fuel. The difficulties in getting pipelines and other oil and gas projects permitted, with environmental groups holding up projects for years, serves as a disincentive to invest in oil and gas production that would be needed in the years to come, Medlock said. If the administration starts to send a message of balance, it produces an environment for everything to move forward, he said. If you start denigrating the incumbent sources of energy, capital stops flowing and you end up in this place where nobody wants to be. Uncertainty about climate policy isn't helping either, said Logan Webb Cirrus. With Republicans and Democrats in Congress unable to reach any kind of agreement on climate, companies and investors are left to guess what future regulations might look like. You could say that this is what a disorderly energy transition might look like, Logan said. From the Midland Reporter Telegram opinion page, Friday, June 24th. Syndicated columnist. What would happen if Biden ran big oil? Opinion by Charles Lane. President Joe Biden visits Saudi Arabia in July to mend fences with its de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, after previously exonerating the country as a pariah because of its awful human rights record. In return, the Saudi leader, known as MBS, is expected to boost oil production to help ease U.S. gas prices and bolster Biden's political fortunes. Meanwhile, Biden took a somewhat more punitive stance toward the U.S. domestic oil industry, previously arraigned by Democrats for pumping out fossil fuels regardless of climate change, and now chided in a presidential letter for inadequate supply and refinery profit margins well above normal being passed directly onto American families. And the president is recommending a 3-month suspension of the federal 18.4 cents a gallon gasoline excise tax, as well as calling on states to cut their equivalent levies. All of which raises a question. What would Biden do instead of being forced to hector, cajole, and plead if he ran an oil company himself? What if the United States, the world's number one petroleum producer, nationalized its resources, as countries accounting for 75% of world production have? What would Biden do with the same kind of control over the United States' output that MBS has over Saudi Arabia's and Russian President Vladimir Putin has over Russia's? It's a hypothetical question, and as such, clarifying. The likely answer is the president probably wouldn't quite know which way to turn at first, but would soon face strong incentives to make the status quo even worse. The United States' chronic energy policy incoherence stems from basic economic reality, not corporate greed or governmental mistakes, though neither factor is blameless. Specifically, the United States has a conflict of interest. It is, uniquely, the world's largest oil and gas producer and the largest consumer, accounting for a fifth of global output and a fifth of global consumption. Many, if not most, other countries produce more oil than they consume, such as tiny Kuwait and Norway, or consume far more than they produce, such as wealthy, industrialized, but petroleum-poor Germany and Japan. This makes it easy for them to have pretty clearly developed and relatively consistent views on energy policy, as Mike Wirth, the chief executive of Chevron, noted on a recent visit to the Washington Post. In the U.S., we've been able to get away with being a little sloppy because we've got a big industrial economy and we're also blessed with a big energy resource. Wirth, a target of Biden's recent complaints, is not an unbiased source, nor, however, is he an unknowledgeable one. In this case, he has a point. Policy cannot simultaneously maximize gas price affordability, incentives for domestic production, and environmental protection. Yet those are the contradictory directions in which U.S. policy pushes, because those are the contradictory directions in which voters and lobbyists constantly tug. If the president wore a second hat as de facto CEO of Nationalized Big Oil Incorporated, they would tug on him too. The policy wonks who, interestingly but unconvincingly, back nationalization see things differently. The Democracy Collaborative's Carla Scandier, for example, has proposed a federal buyout of 51% of the oil companies. Only Democratic government can ensure the planned wind down of fossil fuel production in accordance with climate safety goals, she writes. With room for private profit cut out of fossil fuel extraction and production, the powerful entrenched opposition of the energy sector would crumble. Perhaps, but oil nationalization would also remove big oil as a convenient scapegoat for higher prices at the pump, making Biden himself, or any other president, the unshielded target of consumer fury. Any politician accountable at the polls for gas prices would lean toward keeping it cheap, even to the detriment of objectives such as a balanced government budget, investing in expanded production, or fighting climate change. The history of relatively democratic oil-producing countries with nationalized industries such as Mexico, or before the Maduro dictatorship, Venezuela, certainly suggests as much. Both pursued, even subsidized, cheap gas with massively wasteful consequences. More power could cost ratepayers $1.5 billion, by Shelby Webb, staff writer. Texas's efforts to have more reserves of electricity on the power grid could ultimately cost ratepayers roughly $1.5 billion this year, an independent market monitor told the Texas House's State Affairs Committee on Wednesday. Carrie Bivens, a third-party consultant hired by the Public Utility Commission to study the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, said the grid manager's increased reliance on buying up reserve power and operating more conservatively has skewed price signals and fundamentally changed how the state's wholesale power market functions. As of May 31st, Bivens estimated ERCOT has spent between $685 million and $860 million this year by purchasing more reserve power and changing elements of the wholesale power market in order to procure more electricity before it's needed. That's far more than the roughly $400 million the state spent on those conservative operating measures from June 2021 through the end of this year, Bivens said. Public Utility Commission Chair Peter Lake and ERCOT Interim CEO Brad Jones have said the more conservative operations are meant to be temporary and are a stopgap measure to ensure reliability until the PUC finalizes the changes it wants to make to the wholesale power market, which officials hope to finish by the 2023 legislative session. Lake said the new posturing has already showed positive results. We're no longer waiting until the grid gets on the brink before we bring more reserves and more resources to bear to ensure it's reliable, he said. We've seen the results. In the last 12 months, we've had at least 6 days where the grid reserves were so low that if we had not built in that margin of safety and those extra reserves, we would have been on the brink of rolling blackouts. Part of the new operating procedures is forcing and paying generation units to sit on the sidelines and be ready if they're needed in case of tight grid conditions. That stands in contrast to how the power market has operated since it was deregulated in 2000, where power generators only get paid when they're producing power, said Michelle Richmond, executive director of the Texas Competitive Power Advocates, a trade group for power generators and other market participants. Many of the units that have been called to sit on the sidelines are older natural gas and coal-powered units, plants that have been in operation for decades, in some cases nearly 50 years, according to testimony the Texas Senate Committee on Business and Commerce heard in March. Richmond said having those units humming on the sidelines puts more wear and tear on them and could make them less reliable in the future. Those units are designed to run a couple of weeks of the year. Not all the time, she said. It makes the maintenance needs more frequent and potentially more comprehensive, also going to be more costly. The costs of conservative operating measures will inevitably trickle down to tax ratepayers, said Tim Morstad, Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach at AARP Texas. And ratepayers are already being saddled with paying off costs associated with the February 2021 freeze and power rates that have nearly doubled in a year, thanks in part to abnormally high natural gas prices. Texans are struggling, and the public needs an effective channel to weigh in before impacts like these are put into motion, he said. Lake said the PUC's priority is reliability. But that insurance will come at a cost, both with these temporary measures and in the redesigned power market. There will be some cost increases. We had a low-performing market, and we need to enhance it. We need to improve it, Lake said. That's the cost-benefit trade-off. It's our job to make sure it's worth the trade-off. U.S. mortgage rates rise to 5.81% by Prashant Gopal, Bloomberg. Mortgage rates in the U.S. climbed again, hovering near a 14-year high. The average for a 30-year loan was 5.81%, up from 5.78% last week, Freddie Mac said in a statement Thursday. Rates diverged from the decline in yields for 10-year treasuries. The latest increase for the 30-year loans follows the biggest one-week jump since 1987. This year's massive run-up in borrowing costs has fueled a sudden shift in the previously frenzied U.S. housing market. More sellers in some of the hottest pandemic boom towns are cutting prices. Sales of previously owned homes fell in May to the lowest level in nearly 2 years, according to data released this week. The combination of rising rates and high home prices is likely the driver of recent declines in existing home sales, said Sam Cotter, Freddie Mac's chief economist. However, in reality, many potential home buyers are still interested in purchasing a home, keeping the market competitive, but leveling off the last 2 years of red-hot activity. The slowdown has led to major layoffs across the industry. The biggest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, is laying off hundreds of home lending employees and reassigning hundreds more. Brokerages Compass Incorporated and Redfin Corporation are also cutting hundreds of workers. Market prices will continue adjusting to a smaller pool of qualified buyers and higher financing costs, George Ratio, Realtor.com's manager of economic research, said in a note. The move from an overheated real estate market toward a more sustainable one will take some time. For buyers of a median-priced home, the double whammy of soaring prices and higher rates has pushed monthly mortgage payments to about 64% more than last year, according to Raytu. Uvalde victim's sister pleads for gun safety measures, by Jim Vertuno and Jamie Stengel, Associated Press, Austin. The sister of a 9-year-old girl killed in the Uvalde school shooting rampage tearfully pleaded on Thursday with Texas lawmakers to pass tougher gun laws and questioned why so many security measures failed. "I'm here begging for you guys to do something," said Jasmine Cazares, whose young sister Jacqueline was one of 19 children shot to death in the 80 minutes the gunman spent inside Robb Elementary School on May 24th before police stormed the classroom and killed him. Two teachers also died in the massacre. "People who were supposed to keep her safe at school didn't," the 17-year-old Cazares said through sniffles. "They failed." Her testimony came just as the U.S. Supreme Court announced a decision allowing a major expansion of gun rights, saying Americans have a right to carry firearms in public. Cazares told a committee of lawmakers looking at how to prevent mass shootings that they could honor the victims by adopting gun background checks and red flag laws that allow for the removal of firearms from people at extreme risk of harming themselves or others. The gunman was a former student, Salvador Ramos, who days after turning 18 bought the AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle he used in the attack. The Republican-controlled legislature in Texas has stripped away gun restrictions over the past decade, even as the state has suffered through a string of mass shootings that killed more than 85 people in the past 5 years. The state doesn't require a permit to carry a long rifle like the one used in Uvalde. Last year, lawmakers made it legal for anyone 21 and older to carry a handgun in public without a license, background check, or training. "Jacqueline loved singing and dancing and wanted to go to Paris when she graduated," her sister said. "She was one of the sweetest souls anybody would ever meet," Cazares said. Supreme Court expands gun rights for states, by Jessica Gresko, Associated Press, Washington. In a major expansion of gun rights after a series of mass shootings, the U.S. Supreme Court said Thursday that Americans have a right to carry firearms in public for self-defense, a ruling likely to lead more people legally armed. The decision came out as Congress and states debate gun control legislation. About one quarter of the U.S. population lives in states expected to be affected by the ruling, which struck down a New York gun law. The High Court's first major gun decision in more than a decade split the court 6-3, with the court's conservatives in the majority and liberals in dissent. Across the street from the court, lawmakers at the Capitol sped toward passage of gun legislation, prompted by recent massacres in Texas, New York, and California. Senators cleared the way for the measure, modest in scope, but still the most far-reaching in decades. Also Thursday, underscoring the nation's deep divisions over the issue, the sister of a 9-year-old girl killed in the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, pleaded with state lawmakers to pass gun legislation. The Republican-controlled legislature has stripped away gun restrictions over the past decade. President Joe Biden said in a statement he was deeply disappointed by the Supreme Court ruling. It contradicts both common sense and the Constitution and should deeply trouble us all, he said. He urged states to pass new laws. I call on Americans across the country to make their voices heard on gun safety. Lives are on the line, he said. The decision struck down a New York law requiring people to demonstrate a particular need for carrying a gun in order to get a license to carry a gun in a concealed way in public. The justices said that requirement violates the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote for the majority that the Constitution protects an individual's right to carry a handgun for self-defense outside the home. That right is not a second-class right, Thomas wrote. We know of no other constitutional right that an individual may exercise only after demonstrating to government officers some special need. California, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Rhode Island all have laws similar to New York's. Those laws are expected to be quickly challenged. Governor Kathy Hochul, Democrat, New York, said the ruling came at a particularly painful time, with New York mourning the deaths of 10 people in a shooting at a supermarket in Buffalo. This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want, she said. Gun control groups called the decision a significant setback. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice and an expert on the Second Amendment, wrote on Twitter that the decision could be the biggest expansion of gun rights by the Supreme Court in U.S. history. Republican lawmakers were among those cheering the decision. Tom King, president of the plaintiff New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, said he was relieved. The lawful and legal gun owner of New York State is no longer going to be persecuted by laws that have nothing to do with the safety of the people and will do nothing to make the people safer, he said. And maybe now we'll start going after criminals and perpetrators of these heinous acts. The court's decision is somewhat out of step with public opinion. About half of the voters in the 2020 presidential election said gun laws in the U.S. should be made more strict, according to AP Votecast, an expansive survey of the electorate. An additional one-third said laws should be kept as they are, while only about 1 in 10 said gun laws should be less strict. About 8 in 10 Democratic voters said gun laws should be made more strict, Votecast showed. Among Republican voters, roughly half said laws should be kept as they are, while the remaining half closely divided between more and less strict. In a dissent joined by his liberal colleagues, Justice Stephen Breyer focused on the toll from gun violence. Since the beginning of the year, there have already been 277 reported mass shootings, an average of more than one per day, Breyer wrote. He accused his colleagues in the majority of acting without considering the potentially deadly consequences of their decision. He said the ruling would severely burden states' efforts to pass laws that limit in various ways who may purchase, carry, or use firearms of different kinds. Several other conservative justices who joined Thomas's majority opinion also wrote separately to add their views. Justice Samuel Alito criticized Breyer's dissent, questioning the relevance of his discussion of mass shootings and other gun death statistics. Alito wrote that the court has decided nothing about who may lawfully possess a firearm or the requirements that must be met to buy a gun, and nothing about the kinds of weapons that people may possess. Today, unfortunately, many Americans have good reason to fear they will be victimized if they are unable to protect themselves. The Second Amendment, he said, guarantees their right to do so. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, noted the limits of the decision. States can still require people to get a license to carry a gun, Kavanaugh wrote, and condition that license on fingerprinting, a background check, a mental health records check, and training in firearms handling, and in laws regarding the use of force, among other possible requirements. Backers of New York's law had argued that striking it down would lead to more guns on the streets and higher rates of violent crime. Gun violence on the rise during the coronavirus pandemic has spiked anew. Gun purchases have also risen. Gun bill on road to passage as Senate overcomes GOP delays, by Alan Fram, Associated Press, Washington. The Senate pushed a bipartisan gun violence bill to the brink of passage Thursday as it voted to halt a Republican filibuster against the measure, clearing the way for Congress's most far-reaching response in decades to the nation's run of brutal mass shootings. After years of GOP procedural delays that derailed Democratic efforts to curb firearms, Democrats and some Republicans decided that congressional inaction was untenable after last month's rampages in New York and Texas. It took weeks of closed-door talks, but a group of senators from both parties emerged with an 80-page compromise embodying incremental but impactful movement. The measure would toughen background checks for the youngest gun buyers, keep firearms from more domestic violence offenders, and help states put in place red flag laws that make it easier for authorities to take weapons from people adjudged dangerous. It would also fund local programs for school safety, mental health, and violence prevention. Thursday's roll call ended the blockade by conservative GOP senators was 65 to 34, five more than the expected 60-vote threshold needed. Final passage of the $13 billion measure was expected by week's end with the House vote to follow. The timing was uncertain, but Congress was scheduled to leave town by the weekend for a two-week break. Even so, the day proved bittersweet for advocates of curtailing gun violence. Underscoring the enduring potency of conservative clout, the right-leaning U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision expanding the right of Americans to carry arms in public. The justices struck down a New York law that has required people to prove a need for carrying a weapon before they get a license to do so. Across the street in the Senate, 15 Republicans joined all 50 Democrats, including their two allied independents, in voting to move ahead on the legislation. Highlighting the risks Republicans face by defying the party's pro-gun voters and the National Rifle Association, Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Todd Young of Indiana were the only two of the 15 up for re-election this fall. Of the rest, four are retiring and eight don't face voters until 2026. The election year package fell far short of more robust gun restrictions Democrats have sought for years, including bans on the assault-style weapons and the high-capacity ammunition magazines used in the slayings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. Yet the accord let leaders of both parties declare victory and demonstrate to voters that they know how to compromise and make government work, while also leaving room for each side to appeal to its core supporters. This is not a cure-all for all the ways gun violence affects our nation, said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat New York, whose party has made gun restrictions a goal for decades. But it is a long overdue step in the right direction. It's significant. It's going to save lives. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, in a nod to the Second Amendment right to bear arms that drives many conservative voters, said the American people want their constitutional rights protected and their kids to be safe in school. He said they want both of those things at once, and that is just what the bill before the Senate will have accomplished. While the Senate measure was a clear breakthrough, the outlook for continued congressional movement on gun curbs is dim. Only about one-third of the Senate's 50 GOP senators backed the measure, and solid Republican opposition is certain in the House. Top House Republicans urged a no vote in an email from the number two GOP leader, Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, that called the bill an effort to slowly chip away at law-abiding citizens' Second Amendment rights. Both chambers, now narrowly controlled by Democrats, could well be run by the GOP after November's midterm elections. In a statement, President Joe Biden said Uvalde residents told him when he visited that Washington had to act. Our kids in schools and our communities will be safer because of this legislation. I call on Congress to finish the job and get this bill to my desk, Biden said. Senate action came 1 month after a gunman killed 19 students and two teachers in Uvalde. Just 10 days before that, a white man accused of being motivated by racism killed 10 black grocery store shoppers in Buffalo. Both shooters were 18 years old, a youthful profile shared by many mass shooters. The talks were led by Senators Chris Murphy, Democrat Connecticut, Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat Arizona, John Cornyn, Republican Texas, and Tom Tillis, Republican North Carolina. Murphy represented Newtown, Connecticut, when an assailant killed 20 students and 6 staffers at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012, while Cornyn has been involved in past gun talks following mass shootings in his state and is close to McConnell. The bill would make the local juvenile records of people aged 18 to 20 available during required background federal background checks when they attempt to buy guns. And now, here is another column from the opinion page published in the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Friday, June 24th. Guest view, San Antonio Express News. Desperate need for transparency and accountability in Uvalde after shooting. 3 minutes. 3 minutes is how long it took for police officers to enter Robb Elementary School in Uvalde after an 18-year-old gunman stormed the building and opened fire with an AR-15-style rifle on May 24th. 3 minutes is an eternity with any gun, especially a semi-automatic rifle that can fire at least 45 rounds per minute. According to the Texas Department of Public Safety's latest timeline, the shooter fired more than 100 rounds between 11:33 and 11:36 a.m. The first police officers arrived at 11:36, and for the next 74 minutes, periodic gunshots rang out from classrooms 111 and 112, rooms full of children and teachers. Police with ballistic shields, body armor, rifles, and handguns waited in the hallway as children inside called 911. Officers entered the classroom and killed the shooter at 12:50 p.m. DPS Director Steve McCraw pointed to the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District Police Department as he testified at a Texas Senate Special Committee on Tuesday. He called the law enforcement response an abject failure and anti-ethical to everything we have learned over the past 2 decades. He blamed Pedro Pete Arredondo, the department's chief of police and on-scene commander during the shooting, and said, "The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander, who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children." In this latest official version of the tragedy, McCraw de-emphasized his department's role, despite the fact that at least 13 DPS troopers rushed to the school as the shooting unfolded. Some were in the hallway during the long wait. Why did no senior troopers or other law enforcement officials take command from Arredondo? McCraw said troopers did not have the authority by law to take command. But he also told the subcommittee it could be argued that Arredondo turned over on-scene commander duties when he asked for and received help from other law enforcement agencies. McCraw's words are the latest salvo in a battle to control the narrative and save face after 4 weeks of local and state officials blocking and harassing media and ignoring dozens of open records requests. Arredondo must be held accountable. How many people could have been saved if officers had rushed the building? But many people, systems, and safeguards failed Uvalde's children and teachers. Arredondo's failure is amplified by the failure of other officers to act with moral urgency and decisive leadership. The blame does not fall solely on law enforcement in a society awash in guns and led by politicians reluctant to pass gun safety laws. Then there's Texas's abysmal access to mental health care, 51st in the nation. For the families of the 19 children and 2 adults killed and 17 wounded, the shifting story and lack of transparency only add to the pain. They deserve honesty and answers. But since May 24th, officials have said that a teacher left the exterior door propped open and officers didn't have the right equipment, battled communication problems, were thwarted by a locked door, and couldn't find a key. Now we know most of those claims were false. This weekend, the Express News reported that school surveillance footage showed no police checked the door to see if it was locked. Transparency and accountability are desperately needed. McCraw's testimony serves as a starting point. But 1 month after this horror, as misery deepens, we are doubtful either will truly arrive.
Cancer can come back, sometimes years later. Dear Dr. Roach, 16 years ago, at age 56, I was diagnosed with stage 3 HR plus breast cancer. I was treated with a modified radical mastectomy, followed by chemotherapy, 6 weeks of radiation, then about 7 years of oral anti-estrogen drugs. I also had a prophylactic simple mastectomy on the opposite side. My primary care doctor retired last fall. While looking for a new one, I went to my cardiologist, who saw that a chest CT 2 years earlier showed two small lung nodules. She felt that a follow-up was needed, so she ordered it. The follow-up CT showed multiple small lung lesions and a new nodule in the liver. But the radiology report included the statement that low-risk patients required no follow-up. It took 6 months to get a new primary care doctor, and when I shared that I had some concerns about the findings on my scan, she read the report and said, quote, "It says right here that low-risk patients need no follow-up, so don't worry about it," end quote. I read a recent study with a very large number of participants that showed recurrence rates as high as 15% to 20% in patients up to 30 years after treatment. My cardiologist was very upset by the new doctor's response, but says she, quote, "cannot assume the responsibility," end quote. She gave me names of other primary care doctors she highly recommends. This all leaves me a bit confused. My oncologist's office informed me that they do not do any diagnostic work and only treat once a cancer is diagnosed. They told me my primary care doctor should instruct me as to what to do. Should I worry about these results? Am I really a low-risk patient? Should I find a new doctor or stop worrying about it? Answer: I am disappointed in the responses by your primary care doctor and oncologist. You should have had, at a minimum, a careful physical exam and scrutiny of the CT scans to see whether these lung lesions, quote, lesion, end quote, is a nonspecific term that only conveys something that shouldn't be there, and liver nodule are compatible with breast cancer. If they are, your doctors should consider a biopsy. If not, and they may well not be, your doctors should explain why. Having been the primary care doctor in situations like this, I will tell you I work carefully with the oncologist to decide on the right diagnostic plan. You deserve a doctor who will take this seriously and not immediately dismiss you as, quote, low risk, end quote. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach.
Couple's golden years look increasingly dark. Dear Abby, my husband, who is 81 and in excellent health, has just suggested that when we feel we can no longer live independent lives, I am 72, we should move closer to his daughter in another state so she and her husband can help us. Abby, I don't like her husband, and I don't want to be reliant on him, beholden to him, or even socialize with him. In the 15 years I've known him, we have never had a conversation. In the beginning, I tried, but he cannot relate to older women. Apparently, he didn't have a good relationship with his mother. His only topics of conversation are his dogs, guns, or sports. I have no interest in any of those things. It breaks my heart that my husband and I may not be spending the last years of our lives together. I'm sure my husband would tell me to get over my dislike of his daughter's husband. Do I have to agree to be around someone I have nothing in common with? I don't like the part of the country drive of the country they live in either. Signed, Nervous in New Mexico. Dear Nervous, my late mother once told me that parents who count on their adult children taking care of them in their old age are often in for a rude awakening. You and your husband are supposed to be equal partners in this marriage. If you dislike not only the man his daughter is married to, but also the area of the country in which they live, no law says you are obligated to relocate. I recommend you have that difficult discussion with your spouse soon, preferably in the office of a licensed marriage and family therapist. Dear Abby, I've been in an on-and-off relationship with a woman for 3 years. We live about 2 hours apart. In the beginning, our relationship was wonderful. We would see each other on a regular basis and would text and video chat almost daily. We even talked about marriage. But as time went on, she became more and more distant. She would rather take forever to respond. She would either take forever to respond back to me or not respond at all. Her excuse was work. She was always working and always had something going on. I then found out she was dealing with a couple of personal things. When I explained to her that relationships are all about communication, she kind of disagreed. At one point, I was so upset and angry and frustrated that I said some horrible things to her. I even used foul language because of her not communicating. Also, she didn't even bother to take 2 minutes out of her time to wish me a happy birthday. I always remember her on her birthday. She's making me out to be the bad guy. I'm so hurt and angry at her because of her refusal to communicate. What else can I do? Am I really the bad person here? Signed, Uncertain in Pennsylvania. Dear Uncertain, although you refuse to recognize it, this woman has been communicating with you. Her behavior indicates that she is nowhere as interested in you as you are in her, which should have become apparent as she became more and more distant. You are not a bad person, and neither is she. She's just afraid to give you the bad news verbally. In cases like this, there's nothing you can do besides tell her it's apparent she isn't as invested in the relationship as you are and make a graceful exit.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.